Welcome to the Mighty Dragon. Today's guest is actor Mark Wingett, who you'll know as Jim Carver from The Bill, who he portrayed for over 20 years. But for me, he will always be Dave from Quadrophenia. Dave was Jimmy's best friend. But while Jimmy was losing everything, he stole his girl. Quadrophenia captures the essence of the mod movement from the 1960s, depicting its fashion, music, and social dynamics. It explores themes of youth rebellion, disillusionment, and the search for meaning in a rapidly changing world. A British cult classic with the perfect score by The Who, this interview means so much to me personally, as it's one of my favourite films. Welcome to the Mighty Dragon, Mark Wingett.
Thank you very much. Why are you called the Mighty Dragon?
There's a few reasons for the Mighty Dragon. It was named after two of my favourite actors, one being Bruce Lee and the other being John Lone, who are both known as dragons. So kind of just happened. Yes. We're here to talk about your acting career, Quadrophenia, The Bill, and all of that. But what drew you to acting as a career?
English lessons at school, quite simply. I went to a comprehensive school. We had it was a new comprehensive school. There were 3 years there when I joined. When I was a first year, there was a second and a third year. There was a fifth or a sixth year at the time. And it was a kind of a model school, a 70s model school. At the time, it was called Horndean Bilateral, but they did away with that and called it Horndean Comprehensive School. It's now Horndean Community College.
Ah.
So it's kind of changed. But when I went, it was a comprehensive. We had a fantastic English department a few notable teachers, Mrs. Green, Mr. Wheeler, and Mr. Sochon. And I found, I love reading the literature. I like reading the plays. I was that kid at school that's always in the school plays. From school, I got extracurricular sort of drama lessons. And from those drama lessons, I was put in up for, and I went. I joined the National Youth Theatre. And my second year with the Youth Theatre, I was seen, I was spotted, and I got the part of Dave in Quadrophenia.
Yeah. Wow. You were 17. Yeah. So you must have been one of the youngest in the cast.
Yeah, I was the youngest, I think.
Yeah,
I was the baby. A lot of the others also had previous experience, but I had none, of course. My very first day's filming was the egg sandwich scene.
Yes, I know.
that was my very first day. And what did I eat? 21 egg sandwiches that day.
Oh, my God.
I didn't understand if you could fake it.
Yeah.
And then I think we went out for a curry afterwards.
Oh, my God. Nice.
Yeah, the ecstasy going on there.
Oh, gosh. So Quadrophenia is a complete iconic British film. And apart from the performances, what do you think fed into that success? Was it the music, the writing, the directing, or just all of it at the right time?
We often talk about this, and Quadrophenia was very serendipitous. It was a lot of things came together and formed this kind of extraordinary piece of art, you know. So if you think about it, you've got The Who then were probably a prog rock band.
Yeah.
Certainly a rock band. It was made in 78, harking back to 64. It was about this young kid who's a loser who wants to commit suicide or not, as the case may be. It's got all these punk rockers in it, dressed as mods.
Yeah, right.
And it kind of just sort of comes together.
Yeah.
Pete Townshend's music, of course, is completely essential to Quadrophenia, and I think it's a genius piece of music. Pete can't seem to leave it alone. He knows he did something extraordinary with it, you know. And he's always going back. He's always adjusting it. He's always doing things with it. He released a commemorative, a quadraphonic recording about, it's getting on for 10 years ago now. He's done classical quadraphonia. You know, he just seems to be in there. I went to a great thing in Acklam Hall he did, talking about how he made the album Quadraphonia. Basically by just locking himself in a room in his studio and just going through these music, through this music and coming up with the demo tapes and then taking it to the Who and then recording it and, you know, going back. And so it's kind of all of those things. It captures a zeitgeist of the time, which was 1978, which was, you know, just about post-punk. Punk had just sort of almost finished by then. There was an incredible optimism amongst us teenagers at the time. You know, we felt like we were rewriting history. We weren't, of course. You know, we weren't rewriting history, but we felt like it. So, yeah, like, I think it was just really lucky that all those things came together. Of course, we had a brilliant actor in the lead role with Phil Daniels.
Yes.
With that part. And also a maverick, extraordinary director, Frank Rodham, who didn't do what the Who wanted him to do with it, and he went and did his own thing.
Really?
And they went, okay, go for it, you know.
Okay.
He fought for what he thought was right. He took a chance on kids like me who had no previous acting experience, you know, that could have, except amateur stuff, that could have fallen on its face. So it was all of those things. It was all of those things, and somehow it just came together.
Incredible.
Of course, you don't go out to make a cult movie, you know. As time has kind of marched on, it's been recognised as, it was people's favourite film, you know.
Yeah.
Have a real fondness for it, and I think it's more popular now than it ever was, to tell the truth.
Absolutely. I find the time that it was released is interesting, because Ray Winston was also in Scum as well, another to me it's kind of similar, that sort of rage, the teenage rage types of films. I think they're very popular.
Another film which is not often seen, called That Summer, which he was lead in as well. So he did three films in a year. Right. You know, he was always destined for greatness.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Can you share any memorable or funny behind-the-scenes moments from Quadraphonia?
Every day was a bit of a laugh, you know. It was extraordinary. We did a lot of kind of rehearsal. I think we were together for about a month before we actually made the film, because Frank wanted us all to gel together and get to know each other and blah, blah, blah.
All right.
Hang around with each other and hung around and went out to nightclubs and bits and pieces, and we got invited to a party, and then the production company hired us scooters, all these 125s. So we went to a party one night with all these 125s, and we all had a bit too much to drink, and there was this sandpit outside this house. So we were just driving these scooters into these 125s into this sandpit and rolling off them, you know. It's just like madcap things like that, you know.
Yeah.
Just being an exuberant youth, really. You know, it was the film's about a mod as a rite of passage. And that film for us was a rite of passage as well. So when we get together, we just instantly click, because it's like meeting family again. It truly is like meeting family. Well, last time I saw Toya, she said, I don't really feel comfortable with anybody else. She said, it's just us lot, really.
It's crazy. The amount of people in that film who have just had incredible careers since Quadraphonia. I mean, Sting as well. They were just breaking, weren't they, the Police at the time?
Yeah, Sting invited us to go and watch his band one night. He went, you're all right, mate. You're too soft for us. That's what I call him. It's fine, mate. It's all right.
Yeah.
One of the gigs, you know. We have these scooter riding lessons. I could ride a bike. I've still got a bike. It was out in Harrow. We did dance rehearsals above this strip club in Soho called the Doll's House. It was a dance studio above it.
Right.
Driven out from the Doll's House out to Harrow to have these scooter riding lessons. And Sting's kind of career had started off, it was 1978. In January 1978, they released Roxanne. But it didn't do anything in 78. So what the record did is, under the name Clark Kent and the Supermen, they released another Police record. So we're sat in this car. I'm behind Sting in this car. And we're all nattering away. Sting goes, "That's me. That's me. That's me on the radio. Oh, my God." And he turned it up. It was the first time he'd heard himself on the radio. And it wasn't the Police. It was Clark Kent and the Supermen.
Yeah.
Here's a funny thing. Okay, right. So we're filming down in Brighton. It's the start of filming. Sting has this, it actually became a very famous appearance on the Old Grey Whistle Test.
Yeah.
Rock programme at the time. But he was getting made up in the morning as he finished filming and rushed up to London to meet the band and record the music. And they sprayed this hairspray on, you know, that ridiculous hairdo he had. They sprayed this hairspray on him. It went in his eyes. So his eyes all swirled up. So he wore these massive glasses, these sunglasses, and this jumpsuit. Yeah. Oh, look. Glass, that's very weird. What's all that about?
That's strange.
So he did the three songs or the two songs, you know, "I Can't Stand Losing You." That was his single at the time. That was his new single. With his massive sunglasses and his kind of parachute jumpsuit on, you know, which became his look. That became his look. And it was kind of a
wow.
Yeah. I've still got, he signed a copy of "Can't Stand Losing You" on blue vinyl, a 7-inch copy. And he signed it for me, Stingo. Now, yeah. Don't believe me. He says, "That's not Sting." I said, "It is." He signed it for me in the hotel lobby. So it was that kind of thing. It was, you know, they were kind of incidences.
Was there any strange Keith Moon moments on set?
He died a couple of weeks before started filming, and it wasn't sure whether the filming was going to go ahead or not.
But right. Oh, my God.
It did, yeah. We're all in rehearsals and Keith Moon died, you know. Really sad. And it's funny, because I was 17, he was 33 when he died, which we know is no age whatsoever. He just seems so old. All of the Who seemed so old to us at 33 years of age, you know. But then we were teenagers.
Moving on from post-Quadrophenia, what were your main ambitions as an actor after that?
Quadrophenia was a one-off. I'd always wanted to be an actor. And I just wanted to work. That was my ambition, was to work, you know, which I did for many years. I was kind of one of the new wave of actors that were around at the time with Phil and Trevor Laird and other actors, you know.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of stuff in theatre. And I jumped straight into another film called Breaking Glass that Phil was also in with Hazel O'Connor. I did a stage play, was seen in that, did a TV series, did another TV series, and blah, 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 blah. You know, I kind of realised I was a bit lacking in the sort of technical department at this, because I didn't actually formally train. It had been my intention after the National Youth Theatre to go to drama school, to finish my A-levels and go to drama school, but I didn't go back to school again. You know, just couldn't go back to school. I was working. I got a great agent, Jonathan Alteraz, who was a fantastic agent, and for a good few years I had it very, very good, you know. I had it very good, made films and TV series and did theatre shows, and then I did the Pilot of the Bill, which was, you know, which was
yeah,
something which was extraordinary, you know.
20 years on the bill, over 20 years as Jim Carver. What captivated you most about this character, about his evolution?
Well, you don't think of evolution because it was only ever a six-month contract, a six-month rolling contract. And the way it happens is we made a TV series, one episode of a TV, well, not even a TV, it's a pilot episode. And it all went quiet. And about a year later, they said, do you want to make a TV series? So we went, yeah, we'll just make a TV series. So they set up this extraordinary little base in Docklands, and we made the first series of 12 episodes. That was that. 6 months later, they said, do you want to make the second series? And that, and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, that was the evolution of the show. So it was initially 12 episodes at a time. We made three series of that, of those, from made in Docklands and then made in Ladbroke Grove. And then they went half an hour. And then they moved the base, so it went off air for a while, and they moved the base, and they set up a new base, and, you know. So between the first and second series, there was a year. Between the second and third series, there was a two-year gap. Between the one-hour episodes and the half-hour episodes, they set that up in 6 months, and then when it became half-hour episodes, it became a continual programme, a continuing drama, although they were, you know, each episode was standalone. Again, very exciting, slightly groundbreaking thing to do. No one had seen the police in that light before. No one had quite filmed in that way before. And there was a great freedom about what you wanted to do with your character, you know. And I wanted to portray Carver as maybe a bit naive and a bit silly, and. And your character develops with the series, you know, as the writers realise what you're capable of, and what you can do and what your limitations are, they'll write to you. So
okay.
I can't complain. I was very well served with scripts, and I mean, I had some incredible storylines on that show, you know.
Yes. Wow. Over 20 years. It's crazy, isn't it, when you
on you. Back at that. When did I come out? In 2005, I think. Yeah, something like that.
I recently interviewed Maria Austin, who you played alongside in Mercy. Can you tell us more about that, the character you portrayed, and how you prepared for that role?
Right. Now, I'll tell you the history to it. Is Maria probably said, it's a film written by Wendy Morgan, who an old friend of mine from the 80s. And she is vegan. And there was an abattoir near her that Chill Meats, they were called, who had a court case against them for mistreating the animals that they were slaughtering. Wendy was so disgusted, she decided to write a stage play. And she asked me if I wanted to be in the stage play and play the slaughter man, and go up to Edinburgh and went, oh, yeah. Slaughter man, yeah. And then it fell through. And she decided to make a film. So she self-financed the film. She acted in it, she directed it, she filmed it, she produced it, she edited it, she did, you know, with other people, but it was mainly her drive. It's probably one of the most moving pieces I've ever done. And it's all about how we treat pigs.
Yeah.
Take pigs to slaughter. It's a very, very moving piece. How I prepared for it, it's funny, there's a wonderful actor, Adrian Dunbar, who I worked with in the 80s, and we all during the process of rehearsals for this particular job, he described how he used to work in a pig factory and would split the carcasses of these pigs. And it struck me at the time how kind of brutal that is. So what you kind of realize is that if you're dealing death all day long and you're killing things, you become a bit desensitized and you start messing around with animals and doing things you really should not, really disgusting things you shouldn't be doing to them, you know, because you're desensitized, because you're killing things all day long. So kind of thinking, what happens to these guys that work in these places, and how mentally ill are they? I'm not saying that all slaughter men are mentally ill, but this particular character, I'm thinking, how deranged is he going to be? Because he is the main villain of the piece. He is the guy that you know, stuns and kills Mercy. And Mercy's a little piglet or a pig, you know. So he's an extreme character. He's quite an extreme character. But I think you'd hopefully have a little bit of compassion for him, because that's his job. That's what he does all day long. He kills things. And we know anatomically, pigs are almost the same as human beings. They call humans, cannibals call humans the long pigs. There was a rock band called the long pigs. Because we're anatomically very, very close to pigs. So that was my kind of, I didn't want to go around an abattoir, but what Wendy did was send me a load of animal rights footage, which disgusted me, truly disgusted me about what we do to, you know, for factory farming. So much so that I went vegan.
You did? Yeah.
Yeah, I went vegan. I got ill and use kind of nutrition that was milk-based. I've not been able to put the milk down, so I'm vegetarian now.
Okay.
I was vegan for many years, and that was the power of that footage that Wendy sent me. And that's how I did the research, really, you know.
That's incredible.
We talked with Wendy about, you know, the psychological effects of what they do for a job affects them, and why they treated the animals the way they did. It's because they've been brutalized, you know.
Yeah.
And they're people of a certain kind, you know, of a. Well, nobody wants to be a slaughterman.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, kind of, yeah. Job
into. Unless you are a true psychopath, and I don't think they really are, you know. Things all day long, it's going to affect you, isn't it? I was kind of thinking in those sort of areas, you know. And Maria is such a lovely character. She's such a lovely actress. She's gorgeous, you know. And we sat through the first showing and we held hands. It was kind of just holding hands. She's like, she was really scared. And her dad, her parents were there. And I said to her dad, what do you think? And he said, well, I think it's a very moving film. He said, but it's very hard to watch your daughter being urinated on. Not, they don't urinate on her. It appears to be urinated on, you know. Actually, yeah, I never thought of that. I don't pee on her.
How do you balance staying true to a character versus bringing your own unique interpretation to a role?
Well, I don't think there's any difference, you see, because you're hired to do a job. You do that job as best you can. And they hire you because of the qualities of you as an actor. And having been a director, you realise that as an actor, you can't play every role because you're not suited for some roles, you know. So it's a collaboration with the director about how the part is going to be played, how you play certain scenes, you know, what informs the character, your I hate the word, motivations through certain scenes, through the movie maybe, and your own imagination. And there's no difference between, you know, there's no difference. It's the same thing. A good leading actor can change a job if they're given enough freedom, you know, they can change a job. So you hire Tim Roth because he's Tim Roth and you know what he can do. You hire Daniel Day-Lewis, the finest actor, you know, in the world. He you know what you're getting, and you know the commitment, and you know what he's going to bring to a part. So, you know, there's no trade-off between the two things there. I think it's the same thing.
Just going on to your personal life now, and you're such a busy actor because your IMDb credits, you have thousands and still thousands of things coming up. How do you manage your work-life balance, or don't you manage it?
It's been great. I've had some time off recently. I've gone, whoa, I'm going to take some time off now. And I went and did what I really love, which is I loved acting. Yes, I really love acting. But I really love scuba diving as well. So I went scuba diving in a couple of places, which was amazing, and did some underwater photography and stuff, you know, which is great. Which was the first time I'd done that for a long, long time, is to go abroad for periods of time and, you know, go to different places. So that was great. I was just in a position I could do that. And I went, I'm going to go away. I'm going to take the time to do it. Thank you very much. And I probably lost a couple of jobs, actually. First time ever, I went, no, I'm going to take some time for me.
Good for you.
I'm going to take some time for me. It's a vocation, acting. What I'm trying to, my diving club, my scuba diving club, they're all professional men and women, and they book things. They've booked a holiday up for January next year, which is anathema to me because I can't think that far ahead. I mean, I'm going to go on that trip, and they've paid for their flights already. And I'm going, but it's 9 months away. It's like,
yeah,
you know, actors are sort of last minute merchants.
Yeah,
or last minute merchants. Actors are chaotic anyway. You know, we're chaotic and we don't really plan things, and things take us by surprise. But we can adapt. We can adapt quite quickly to stuff, you know. So through my love of scuba diving, I'm having to be organised, which is a bit difficult, really, because I'm a bit bonkers, you know. I'm a bit eccentric and forget things.
Where's the best place to scuba dive, then?
Oh, there's lots. I went to a place called Truk Lagoon, which is Truk Lagoon, which is in Micronesia, which is east of the Philippines, east of Papua New Guinea, northeast of New Zealand. So it's in the South Pacific.
Yeah.
On the seabed there is the Japanese Imperial Naval Fleet that was sunk by the Americans and the British, to a lesser extent, in 1944. So you dive on, you go on a liveaboard ship, boat, a vessel, and you dive on these Second World War shipwrecks.
Yeah.
Are extraordinary. So I went to Truk Lagoon. I'd always wanted to go to Japan. We had to go through Japan to get there. So I spent a few days in Japan, where, incidentally, I met up with the Tokyo Mods, who were absolutely charming and lovely and funny and great. And we were riding around Tokyo on scooters and it was fantastic. And then,
yeah,
friends were in contact. And a few of them are coming over for a mod event this summer. So I can't wait to see them.
Brilliant.
That was just brilliant. I went from Milo and just made some new friends in Tokyo. It's just like, wow. And then I went to the Maldives in January. The Maldives.
Oh, wow.
Ocean. Again, on a liveaboard, and saw manta rays and different thing. Whole reef. No shipwrecks, but one shipwreck. Manta rays and whale sharks and sharks and massive fish. And just brilliant.
Wow. That's great. Amazing. What advice would you give to aspiring actors entering the industry?
I think you... Do you have to be an actor? Do you have to act? Do you have to act like you have to breathe? Because if you don't even bother. because I think acting's a sickness. I think it's something you have to do in wherever, you know. It's just I found acting, you know, I could portray characters, etc. It's about commitment and it's about having fun as well, you know. But if you're not willing to make that level of commitment, then don't even bother, because nobody's gonna just give it to you, you know. There's 1,000 other actors behind you going for that part. You might be lucky, you know. And acting's not a short game. It's about longevity. And it's about, I mean, my career is now 44 years and I'm still acting. And I feel very lucky to have been able to do that. Acting professionally is a privilege, and it's taken me a long time to realise that. It's an absolute privilege to do what I do. So, I mean, I think Donald Sutherland told his son, Kiefer Sutherland, is be nice to people and don't bump into the furniture. I think it's so it's about a level of commitment. Nobody's going to hand anything to you. You're going to have to go and make those chances yourself, and you do that by applying yourself, you know. That's all I can say as advice. But it is great fun as well, you know.
That's great. Final question. What are your plans for 2024? Do you know?
No. Who knows? You know? I've got a couple of, my next job, now this is... My next job, I'm doing a film called Pearls. It's a short movie. It is a short, this one. And I'm playing a man who turns people into oysters.
That sounds up my street.
Yeah, and it's an analogy for the lengths people go to have children. So, now, funnily enough, I was talking to my daughter about it, who's also an actress, but she does this thing called intimacy coordination, which is so she oversees scenes, intimate scenes, etc. Yeah. I said, I've got a job. And she says, oh, have you, Dad? I went, yeah, I'm playing the man who turns people into oysters. She went, it's not called Pearls, is it? I said, yes. She said, I'm on that as well. I said, what? What? She said, I'm the intimacy coordinator on it. I went, oh, God. She said, thank God I don't have to do any intimacy with you, because that would really be embarrassing. So,
oh my gosh.
I was talking to the director because we had a little chat beforehand. We're going to have a day's rehearsal next week and then going to film it the week after. And I said, how did you get hold of me? He said, well, we knew Jamila. And someone said, do you know who her old man is? I went, no, it's Mark. I went, oh, it'll be good in this part. So my daughter got me a part.
That's great. She'll be asking for commission next.
Oh, that's the immediate future. I'm involved as a producer of a TV series, which looks like it might happen. Right. Producer, and I'm playing a character, and I'm playing a hitman, which will be fun. In that, it's a dark comedy.
Yeah.
There's other projects in the offing as well, so it's kind of. I kind of put on my producer's hat and I put on my writing hat. So and also there's a horror anthology called Dark Ditties Presents, which we're trying to get made. Just working really.
Loads going on.
So lots of pieces. So work-wise, that's what I'm doing. I've got some great motorcycle trips planned. For 2024 and some diving in 2025. So there we go.
Brilliant. All the best with everything. And thank you for sharing your memories of Quadrophenia and passing your pearls of wisdom, talking of pearls, to us today on the Mighty Dragon. And hope to see you back here soon. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.